Welcome to the weekend edition of the Daily Stoic. Each weekday, we bring you a meditation inspired by the ancient Stoics, something that can help you live up to those four Stoic virtues of courage, justice, wisdom, and temperance. And here on the weekend, we take a deeper dive into those same topics. We interview Stoic philosophers, we reflect, we prepare, we think deeply about the challenging issues of our time, and we work through this philosophy in a way that's more possible here when we're not rushing to work or to get the kids to school, when we have the time to think, to go for a walk, to sit with our journals, and to prepare for what the future will bring. Hims is changing men's healthcare by providing access to affordable sexual health treatments from the comfort of your couch. It's always sensitive talking about these things, but Hims is changing men's healthcare by providing access to doctor-trusted ED treatments such as chewable hard mints, brand name treatments like Viagra, or generic alternatives for up to 95% cheaper. The process is simple and 100% online. No uncomfortable doctor's visits. If prescribed, your medication ships to you for free. No insurance needed. Start your free online visit today at hims.com/TDS. That's hims.com/TDS for your personalized ED treatment options. Hard mints are a chewable compounded products which are not approved by or verified for safety or effectiveness by the FDA. Prescriptions require an online consultation with your healthcare provider who will determine if appropriate. Restrictions apply. See website for details and important safety information. Subscription required. Price varies based on product and subscription plan. The Daily Stoic is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. One of the cool things about podcasts is that you can multitask while you're listening, but depending on what you're doing right now, like for instance, if you're not in some kind of moving vehicle, there's something else you could be doing. You could be getting an auto quote from Progressive Insurance. It's easy and you could save money by doing it right from your phone. Drivers who save by switching to Progressive save nearly $700 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Discounts for having multiple vehicles on your policy, being a homeowner, and more. So just like your favorite podcast, Progressive will be with you 24/7, 365 days a year, so you're protected no matter what. Multitask right now. Quote your car insurance at progressive.com to join over 29 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $698 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations. Hey, it's Ryan Holiday. Welcome to another episode of the Daily Stoic podcast. I think it was with Ego I got to go to New York and do a talk at the 92nd Street Y, which is sort of the prestigious book talk opportunity that authored. I remember wanting to do one for my previous books, but not having sold enough books or been cool enough, I guess, to warrant one. I finally got to do an in-person talk on Ego, although I would say I was sort of in a tiny little room, not the big room that I've seen talks in before. So I was hoping with the Lives of the Stoics, I'd get to, you know, do it bigger and better. And we were looking forward to a live event there in New York City as part of the launch week. But obviously all those plans went out the window, but they were nice enough to agree to a virtual talk. So I gave this talk the day the book came out, which is always a weird day when you put out books. It's this weird sort of limbo zombie day where you're half trying to work and telling yourself you're not, you know, going to refresh Amazon a million times because you know it's bad for the soul and bad for your confidence. On the other hand, it's really hard to actually focus on other stuff. And you really should be trying to move the needle as much as possible. So it was a weird day. It was also the day of the first debate, if you remember. So I wasn't sure how turnout was going to be, but ended up being a great event. Funny enough, my sister called me like moments before I went on just to talk to see how the book was going. And I said, hey, can't talk. I'm about to do this thing. So she dialed in and listened, which is always fun. And I could see her in the comments. Anyways, it was a great event. What I do in it is I sort of walk through the lives of three different Stoics who I think are worth knowing and learning about and what lessons they apply to us. And then we wrap up. I take some questions. So I think you're going to really like this one. I won't belabor the intro. We'll get right into it. And of course, remember, you can check out Lives of the Stoics anywhere books are sold. It's doing great. Just getting the first week sales numbers in now. And, you know, it's good. I'm excited. I appreciate all the support. I hope you guys like the book. And just know I'm hard at work at the next one. And I hope you like this episode. Hi, everyone. It's wonderful to chat with you guys. What we're going to do is I'm going to give a quick talk, maybe 30 or so minutes, and then we'll open it up to questions. If you see the chat window below, you can put your questions in there, and I'm looking forward to answering them. I thought where I'd start is, first off, thanks everyone for supporting the book, for coming out to do this. It's great to see everyone. There's this famous Chinese saying, the idea of may you live in interesting times. And the cleverness of the quip is that this is a bit of a curse, right? Interesting times are interesting, sure, but it also means that things are going wrong often, or the interestingness can get exhausting quite quickly. And I've come to think of the idea of stoicism in similar terms, the idea of may you live in stoical times, or may you live in stoic, in a stoic moment of history, might be a curse of sort of equal proportions. And if we can think about how stoicism has been resurgent in various periods of history, it tends to be associated with disaster, difficulty, crisis, adversity, unrest, warfare, and on down the line. And so when we think about the idea that never has Marcus Aurelius been more relevant, well, part of the reason for that is that Marcus Aurelius was writing during what we now refer to as the Antonine Plague. When we think about why Seneca feels more relevant today than ever, that's because he lived in a decadent society filled with corruption and temptation, Epicurean pleasures, as well as, you know, sort of profound Stoic difficulties. And never before has this Stoic idea that we don't control what happens, but we have to focus on how we respond, really never has that sort of been more rudely reminded to a population than it was to ours, you know, just a few months ago. The Stoic virtues of courage and justice and self-discipline and wisdom, these are ideas that are interesting to read about. And when you suddenly find them sort of playing out on the world stage, you know you are at least living in an interesting moment in history. And, you know, this book, the new book, Lives of the Stoics, I know it just came out today, so I'm sure most of you have not read it yet, although you may have, some of you may have listened to the audiobook already, which means you're tired of hearing me talk. But one of the things I say in the intro is just what a fascinating spectrum of society that the Stoics cover over roughly 500 years of Greek and Roman history. This is a philosophy that begins in Athens, makes its way to Rome. And in between those periods, in between Zeno and Marcus Aurelius, we get people from Spain and Syria and Iraq and Turkey, as well as Italy and Greece. So not only are the Stoics sort of geographically diverse, but then there are male Stoics and female Stoics, and there are rich Stoics and poor Stoics and powerful Stoics and deeply disempowered, disenfranchised Stoics. And so across these stations and backgrounds and genders and experiences, you have them all sort of struggling with the same difficulties of life. In some cases, the very difficulties that you and I woke up and faced this morning. In other cases, unimaginable additional adversity on top of that. You know, this was a time when you could die from a cut on your finger. This is a time when infant mortality may have been as high as 30 or 40% in some cases. This was a time that, if not as sort of politically dysfunctional and chaotic as our moment today, you know, the punishments were much stricter. You could be executed, you could be exiled, you know, civil wars could break out with a few moments' notice. And the Stoics endured this and survived it and teach us really interesting lessons within it. And so what I thought I would do today is pick just three of the Stoics that we could talk about, whose stories I think each individually teach an interesting lesson, and then we can obviously discuss whoever you guys would like.
You know, I start the book with Zeno. Zeno is the founder of Stoicism. I think it's a credit to Zeno that Stoicism is called Stoicism, not Zenoism, as Epicureanism, is named after its founder, or Christianity is named after Christ. You know, the idea that he was humble enough to name his philosophy after the porch that he started it on, to me, is an interesting insight into how Zeno thought. But there's really no better person to have started Stoicism, nor a more perfect way that Stoicism could have been started than as it did for Zeno. He's a successful merchant who suffers a grievous shipwreck, the details of which we're not totally certain about, but we know it was a catastrophic loss. He's completely wiped out, and he arrives in Athens essentially penniless. And so, as I say in the book, this is a moment that could have made Zeno, that could have been the end of Zeno's life. It's a moment that could have been the end of Zeno's impact on the world. But in fact, it's the stage on which he performs his greatest performance. He's in a bookstore. One of the hardest things for the pandemic for me has been the inability to go to bookstores. But he's in a bookstore, and there he hears a man reading a passage from Socrates, just as if you're at this talk with me and I was there talking about a book. Zeno's reintroduced to the works of Socrates, and it sets him on the philosophical journey that then ends up ultimately changing the world and brings all of us together 2,500 or so years later. It's a pretty incredible moment. And in fact, he believed this moment was fated, right? And the reason he believed that was because several years earlier, he'd gone and visited the oracle at Delphi, and they'd given him a prophecy, a prediction about his life. And it's an interesting one. They said, you will become great when you have conversations with the dead. They said that his destiny was to have conversations with the dead. Well, what does that mean? Well, as he walks into this bookstore and hears a man reading the works of Socrates, he realizes this is a conversation with the dead. And this conversation we're having right now, as I'm telling you the story of Zeno, as I'm going to be quoting the other Stoics to you, is a kind of conversation with the dead. What's so fascinating about Stoicism, about reading, what's so incredible about it, is it allows you to have a conversation with people who are long, long gone. This is my copy of Meditations here. And it's incredible to think that I am reading the words that Marcus Aurelius wrote to himself 2,000 plus years ago, and they're as real and as raw and as personal as they were the day he put them down. And so Zeno is made great by this idea of having conversations with the dead. And if we see philosophy, this love of wisdom, as a sort of an ongoing tradition, a passing of the torch from one generation to the other, I think it gives some purpose to what we're doing here even right now, but also as you read in bed before you go to sleep, or as you listen to an audiobook on your commute to work in the morning. Stoicism is this conversation with the wise people from history. So Zeno suffers this shipwreck, and what does he do? He gets to work rebuilding his life. He starts this philosophy. He starts it in the Stoa, the porch. But unlike the other philosophical schools, the Stoa is located in the middle of the Agora, right? We tend to see philosophy and religion as a place away from the busyness of the world. But Stoicism has always been rooted in the hustle and the bustle of things, in the marketplace, in the marketplace of ideas, in the competition, in the noise, in the din of people going about their daily business. And so the Stoicism begins to take root. He begins to acquire students. He begins to talk about things. He's the first Stoic to articulate the four virtues of Stoicism, as we talked about earlier: courage, justice, wisdom, and self-control. These are, as you know, also the four cardinal virtues of Christianity. But we get the Stoics introducing this idea that these four virtues are the key to the good life. They are the key to what the Stoics say as far as living with accordance to nature. And so Zeno begins, he's the prophet, I say in the book. He's the evangelist of Stoicism. He begins to lecture, he begins to teach, and this philosophy starts a journey through the world that you know, remains ongoing to this day. But what I think so interesting about Zeno is, you know, as I said, he arrives penniless and he rebuilds his life. But not just in the sense of you know, going from owning nothing to, you know, the reasonable, you know, sort of accomplishments of a life, but he rebuilds himself spiritually, mentally, you know, in every sense he rebuilds. And that for the Stoics, this is the journey that we're on. This is the journey to the good life. And it's a slow, steady, and methodical one. One of my favorite quotes from Zeno, he says, well-being is realized by small steps, but it is no small thing. And so if we think about this philosophical journey that we're on, the books that we're reading, maybe the therapy that we go to, the late night conversations we have with a friend, a 12-step group that we attend, a lecture like this that we listen to, the journaling that we do in the morning, each one of these things is a small step in the direction towards what we want to, where we want to go. I don't think the Stoics thought that wisdom was a place that you arrived, but I do think they thought it was a destination worth setting one's bearings towards, and that we go and we move towards it as much as we're able to. And so Zeno is the first of the Stoics to put this in motion, by no means the only, by no means the most interesting, but I figured we'd start with the beginning. And when I was thinking about who I wanted to talk to you guys about next, one of the questions I've gotten the most about the book is sort of like, who did I not know about? Who was I interested? Who did I become? The question I was getting most often was who surprised me the most? Who taught me the most? Who was I most unexpectedly intrigued by? And so I wanted to talk a little bit about a Stoic named Agrippinus. Now, he was someone I was vaguely familiar with because he's mentioned briefly in the works of Epictetus. And I was vaguely familiar with this sort of Stoic tension in Nero's regime, but I sort of thought that Seneca was the embodiment of Stoicism at that time. So I was fascinated to learn about Agrippinus. We hear from Tacitus that Agrippinus inherits from his father a hereditary hatred of tyrants, which I thought is a magnificent phase. Now, why did he inherit this hatred of tyrants? Well, I imagine what happened to Agrippinus's father had something to do with that. So Agrippinus's father runs afoul of the emperor and is set to be executed. But the emperor, being very busy and, you know, apparently very sensitive and is always sentencing people to death for offending him, forgets about this sentence. And it's only at a dinner party that a palace dwarf, begins to mock the emperor for failing to execute Agrippinus. And so Agrippinus's father. And so this sets in motion the death of Agrippinus, which you can imagine would be a rather heavy blow for any son to deal with. But we find that this doesn't make Agrippinus bitter. It doesn't drive him to be a drunk. He becomes an able administrator in the Roman Empire, holds all sorts of positions of power, mostly judicial power, and yet always seems to be one of those figures that marches to the beat of their own drummer. That was something I found over and over and over again in the Stoics, that a Stoic dares to be different, a Stoic dares to be themselves. And in fact, one of the great anecdotes that we have from Agrippinus has to do with someone coming up to him and asking, why is he so contrarian? Why is he so strange? And Agrippinus tells the story of a sweater. He says, you know, if there's a sweater and with a stripe in it, you want to be the thread that is of the stripe, not of the boring color of the rest of the sweater. He says, me, I should like to be red. He wants to be the color that stands out, because it's the color that stands out that makes the entire garment beautiful, he says. And he says, if I don't stand out, if I look and act and behave like everyone else, then I would no longer be the red and I would no longer be beautiful. And what we see time and time again in Stoicism is that the Stoics are not afraid to stand out. The Stoics are not afraid to be themselves. And the Stoics are not afraid of looking silly or ridiculous by the standards of that moment. So perhaps it was inevitable that Agrippinus would find himself in a sort of moral battle with Nero, one of the most deranged emperors in Rome's history. And Agrippinus has, again, this hereditary aversion to illegitimate power, which Nero certainly was. And so there's a wonderful story about a fellow philosopher coming. Both Agrippinus and this philosopher have been invited to a banquet being hosted by Nero. For what purpose, we don't know. And the philosopher says to Agrippinus, "Are you going to attend?" And he says, "Do you think I should?" He says, "Do you think I should attend?" And Agrippinus says, "No." And the guy says, Agrippinus says, "Yes, you should go." And the man is surprised because he knows Agrippinus is not going. And so he says, "Why should I go if you're not going?" And Agrippinus says, "Because you were even thinking about it." Right? Agrippinus knew what right and wrong was. He knew where the line was. And the idea of attending some soiree thrown by an illegitimate murderer, the idea that he was going to go kiss somebody's ass, that he would lick someone's boots, was incomprehensible to him. And so again, it shouldn't surprise us that eventually he earns Nero's ire and somehow offends him. And so he's driven to trial on some trumped up charges. We don't know. We do know around the same time, Nero has a poet executed merely for being more talented than Nero. So we can only imagine what someone like Agrippinus must have done. But Agrippinus is exercising, he's working out when he gets the news that he's been brought up on charges and then a jury is out deciding his punishment. And word comes that he's been spared, that he won't be executed. And then word comes that he's been exiled. And Agrippinus simply looks at his friends who the news has been delivered in front of. And he says, "Well, we shall take our lunch on the road." And they leave. And his idea was, and he said famously, "I am not a hindrance to myself." What does that mean? What he means is that he wouldn't make his problems worse ever by bemoaning them. So he would be himself, even if that would mean that he is exiled or unfairly punished. But once that unfair punishment came down, he would not complain about it. He would not cry over spilt milk. He had no hope that you could convert or convince someone as broken as Nero, and he hit the road. And so Agrippinus is, and we'll talk a little bit about this more later, but Agrippinus is one of the few Romans who refused to bend under Nero's will, who refused to cower in front of the mob and insist always on being themselves, which to me is a very key Stoic teaching. We don't add to our troubles. We face our fate bravely, and most importantly, we refuse to compromise on what is essential to us. We will not bend. We will not be anything other than the red that we know that we were meant to be. So the book begins with Zeno, and obviously it's filled with all sorts of interesting characters like Agrippinus in the middle. It was fitting, although there have been modern Stoics, James Stockdale being one, and General Mattis being another more recent one, and there were some Stoics, near the decline and fall of Rome. But I wanted to end with Marcus Aurelius. I felt like there was a nice symmetry of beginning with Z and ending with A. And so Marcus Aurelius to me is sort of the apotheosis, the pinnacle of Stoicism. It's this philosophy that begins, 500 years earlier in a moment of powerlessness and loss. And it culminates in perhaps the only historical example of a philosopher king. The philosophy goes from this, lowly porch to the imperial palace. And so in Marcus, we have a fascinating example of what philosophy can help us be, of the sort of true greatness that philosophy allows us to realize. And what I just love about Marcus's story is its complete lack of precedent in all of history before or since. Here you have Marcus, who is not born to a royal family, and does not marry into a royal family, but somehow he catches as a young boy the eye of the Emperor Hadrian, who does not have a son. And Hadrian somehow senses something in Marcus, something that must have been profoundly inspiring and noticeable. I mean, the idea that the most powerful man in the world would see in a boy whom he is not related to in any way the future of the empire is a pretty incredible thing. And what Hadrian puts in motion is a succession plan where he adopts a man named Antoninus Pius, who's in his 50s, in exchange for Antoninus Pius adopting Marcus Aurelius, the idea being that together they will groom Marcus Aurelius to wear the purple cloak of the emperor. Now, this is ironically a very similar trajectory to Nero, right? Nero is not quite the emperor's son. He's the emperor's stepson. His mother believes that he's destined for greatness. She selects him for a life of greatness early on. She secures for him the best tutors, so on and so forth, that one of those tutors being Seneca. But somehow the process of being a young prince in line for the throne creates one of the worst people in history in Nero. And yet in Marcus Aurelius, it creates one of the greatest people in history. We have this idea that absolute power corrupts absolutely. And yet in Marcus's case, it's the opposite. Somehow it makes him better as a person. Matthew Arnold says, you know, in Marcus Aurelius, we have a man who was given all the gifts of fate and power that one could possibly imagine. And yet somehow he proves himself worthy of it. It's really an incredible story, one that I remain fascinated with every time I think about it. And I think, again, just one of those great historical moments that is not explored enough. If we think about why this happened, how it could have happened, I mean, obviously Stoicism to me is that missing key, but there's sort of two key moments in Marcus Aurelius's life. So one, he is adopted by Antoninus, who seems to be, although not an overtly philosophical figure, one of those people who just seems to naturally embody goodness and greatness and philosophy, even if they're not conscious of it. And Marcus is adopted as a boy. And I think that the idea was that Antoninus Pius might rule for a few years. Marcus would have a chance to familiarize himself, to be educated. The people would get used to him. And then Marcus Aurelius would be a young king who, with the energy of a young king, would rule for many years. Well, what's incredible, it's a fluke of biology and fate. Marcus Aurelius ultimately does not assume the throne until he's in his 40s. So he has this long apprenticeship under a truly great man in Antoninus. And if you haven't read Meditations, in the first book of Meditations, he has a very long list of gratitude of all the things that he learned from Antoninus, which I think is worth reading for any father or leader or writer. It's just a profound paragraph, a sort of a meditation on mentorship, really. But the other pivotal moment in Marcus's life, at about 25 years old, he's studying under a man named Junius Rusticus, a well-known Stoic. And it's Junius who recommends that Marcus read the lectures of Epictetus. And we don't know if Junius has just a copy of Epictetus's lectures or if he in fact attended Epictetus's lectures himself. But what we know is that a book recommendation is given and everyone in this event has been recommended a book. Most of the time you go, oh, sure, I'll get around to that, and you don't. What I think is so incredible is Marcus does read this book, and here you have the future emperor of the world reading the lectures of a slave, a man who had been cruelly who'd been cruelly enslaved by Marcus's predecessors who worked in the court of Nero. And so you have the most powerful man in the world being influenced by a man who not long ago was one of the least powerful men in the world. The only other precedent really I find for this is the relationship between Frederick Douglass and Abraham Lincoln. But anyways, the introduction to philosophy, to Stoicism particularly, I think is the secret. It's the driving force of Marcus Aurelius's greatness. And it sets in motion, another totally unparalleled event in all of world history. As Marcus assumes the throne in his 40s, there is a pesky logistical detail, which is that Antoninus Pius had another son that he gets from Hadrian. Hadrian had adopted a man who had a son. So long story short, it gets complicated. But basically, Marcus Aurelius has a stepbrother. And if you're familiar with royal history in any way, right, what does the ascendant prince have to do before they take power? You have to clean house, right? You can't have any other heirs to the throne. And in fact, as I tell in the book, when Octavian becomes Rome's first emperor, he is advised by his Stoic philosophy teacher to kill Julius Caesar's existing son. He says, one cannot have too many Caesars. So Marcus Aurelius is given absolute power, and here he has a potential rival. And what does he do with this potential rival? I don't think history would have judged Marcus unkindly for dispatching his stepbrother. The man would have been a footnote in history. Instead, Marcus does the only instance that a king, as I know, has ever done this. Marcus names his stepbrother his co-emperor. And so the first thing that Marcus Aurelius does with absolute power is he gives half of it away, and it's an incredible moment. His brother Lucius Verus ends up handling military matters. Marcus handles civil matters, and so again, it's just a magnificent moment. Not only does absolute power not go to Marcus's head, with absolute power, he performs one of the most majestic, magnanimous gestures in all of royal history. Now, we might hope that an emperor who's so thoughtful, who's so kind, who's so philosophically inclined would rule in a time of peace and plenty, and we could have seen from him all sorts of brilliant gestures. If you've seen the movie Gladiator, they have the character playing Marcus Aurelius, you know, try to make Rome a republic again, and free the slaves. Marcus could have done all sorts of amazing things. You know, he could have been a liberator, a rethinker, a refounder of Rome. But instead, his reign is a little bit like Lyndon Johnson's. Lyndon Johnson has all these aggressive social endeavors and plans, and is sort of blindsided by the Vietnam War, which, you know, ultimately consumes the political equity of his presidency. Marcus Aurelius is besieged not just by wars at the foreign border, not just a decaying and crumbling empire in other cases, but early in his reign, begins what we now know as the Antonine Plague. And this plague lasts for something like 15 years. It's a devastating pandemic. It originates in the East. It quickly overwhelms Rome's institutions, obviously overwhelms any sort of rudimentary medical understanding of the time. And so what does Marcus Aurelius do in these crises, whether they're wars or pandemics or civil unrest, or there's even a serious attempted coup on his life? In every instance, what we see is Marcus living up to his philosophy. When things break down, a leader steps up. And that's what Marcus does. And it's incredible. He appoints Galen, the great medical mind of his time, to lead the response to the plague. He personally leads the troops into battle to drive out the invaders. But whereas other previous kings had ruthlessly slaughtered, you know, the so-called barbarians, Marcus embarks on an audacious peace plan when the coup by one of his most trusted generals, and I tell this story at the end of The Obstacle Is the Way, when one of Marcus's trusted friends and generals, declares himself emperor and thus endangers not just Marcus, but Marcus's family and Marcus's legacy. How does Marcus respond? He responds with self-control and with mercy. And he says, let us use this as an opportunity to teach future generations how to deal with civil strife. When the enemy is killed by an assassin, Marcus supposedly weeps because it deprived him the chance of pardoning the man who tried to kill him. So this idea for Marcus of, You know, he says, just that you do the right thing, the rest doesn't matter. These are not idle words. He's tested on these things at almost every moment of his reign, right up to the end. As far as we understand, he catches the plague. He knows that he's marked for death. And his last moments are consumed with how to pass on succession. He consoles his grieving friends. He sends them away so he doesn't affect them. And he thinks of the legacy that is handing on down. So Marcus talks about how we never step in the same river twice, that every time we read something or look at something or think about something.
I've talked a lot about my morning routine here. One of the things I do every morning after I get up is I take a bunch of vitamins that my doctor recommended after some blood tests. I take a vitamin C, a zinc, a omega-3, and I take a couple others who I'm forgetting, but I definitely know whose vitamins I take. And they actually happen to be today's sponsor, and I've been taking them long before Thorne sponsored today's episode. Thorne takes a personalized, innovative, and scientific approach to health and wellness with all their supplements, and they've teamed up with leading medical professionals to bring out highly effective nutritional supplements. Because I'm a runner, I'm always trying to take care of my joints. And with Thorne, I never have to question what's in each supplement. Give your body what it really needs with Thorne. Go to thorne.fit/dailystoic and use code dailystoic for 10% off your first order. That's thorne.fit/dailystoic and use code dailystoic for 10% off your order. thorne.fit/dailystoic. Use code dailystoic. And note, these statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
The thing is different and we are different because we're constantly being remade by atoms and our perceptions. Every time I study Marcus's story, every time I tell it, every time I think about it, I'm touched by it in some new way. And you know, I've been thinking about and writing about Marcus going on a decade and a half now, and it wasn't until really the beginning of this year that it fully struck me just how profound it is that this work of self-control and gratitude and goodness and patience was written during a horrendous pandemic, that he was worried about his life at every moment, that he was worried about the lives of the people that he loved at every moment, that it would have been an overwhelming, all-consuming crisis. And yet he still found the time to do this writing. And you know, when he says, you know, flexibility looks at events and says, you are just what I'm looking for. When he says, no, it's not unfortunate that this happened. It's fortunate that it happened to me and that I've remained unharmed by it and that I can manage to turn it into something good. When he talks about how a fire uses everything that's thrown in front of it as fuel, you know, he wasn't just talking about, you know, the ordinary stresses of the workplace. He wasn't just talking about, you know, an argument with his wife. He wasn't talking about, you know, the piddly concerns of you know, an everyday person. He was talking about some of the worst, most stressful situations you can imagine. So it's really an incredible idea. And I think my favorite line from Marcus, which I rediscovered writing this chapter, is he says, what we must do is remove our passions and replace them with love. And the idea that, again, a man with absolute power who saw the horrors of war and the devastation of a plague and the betrayal of, you know, the backstabbing betrayals of politics, that he would be reminding himself to love everyone and everything and every moment was just a magnificent moment of human greatness to me. So those are the three Stoics I thought I would talk about. If I could conclude on one note, I assume most of the people on this event are Americans. I appreciate you carving out some time this evening, the night of the first debate between Biden and Trump tonight. You know, when I talk about this sort of Stoic moments, you know, may you live in a time where Stoicism is required. I mean, I think this is one of those moments, right? This is what Stoicism was training us for. We are in the midst here in America, not just of a devastating pandemic, but a new civil rights movement. We are watching democratic norms be eroded, if not deliberately flouted, on both sides of the political spectrum. We're watching institutions crumble under the weight of mismanagement and neglect. We're watching people even struggle to agree on what basic principles we want to stand for. But I would also say all of that true, and you know, we could say that sort of blame on both sides thing. We are also staring at a rising, stumbling, bumbling, you know, descent into fascism, or at least the very real possibility of that thing. And when I think about the Stoics, when I think about what they did, whether it's Cato or Thrasea, Helvidius or Marcus Aurelius, whether it's Portia Cato, one of the few women we were able to profile in the book, or on down to General Mattis today, when the Stoics saw something that was wrong, the Stoics stepped up and did something about it. There's even a term for the Stoics of that sort of middle Roman period. They were known as the Stoic opposition, meaning that the Stoics, with the exception of Seneca, who took more of an insider's role in Nero's administration, were pretty unified in their opposition to the excesses and the cruelties and the violations of the law by Nero's administration. And in fact, this stand that they take not only costs the lives of several of the Stoics, leads many of the rest of them into exile, but their stand inspires Marcus Aurelius. Marcus Aurelius, in the beginning of Meditations, credits those early Stoics with teaching him the essentialness of the rule of law, of equality under the law, of a ruler who respects the rights of his citizens, of all citizens, of the importance of freedom of speech and liberty, right? The founding fathers of America, when they are resisting the tyranny of the British, are inspired by Cato. In fact, George Washington puts on a play about Cato at Valley Forge, the lowest moment in American history. Thomas Wentworth Higginson, one of the translators of Epictetus, leads a black regiment of troops for the Union cause in the Civil War. So this idea that I wanted to conclude with the idea with a clear argument against this idea of the sort of the apathetic Stoic, the resigned Stoic, the Stoic who doesn't get involved. In fact, what you'll see in almost every one of these stories is that the Stoic does get involved. When the Stoic sees something, they say something. The Stoic does not care much for political parties. They don't care much about the quibbles over this policy or that policy, but they do care about sort of basic bedrock ideas of liberty, of justice, right? The idea that the Stoics would look at the civil rights movement that we're having here in America and be anything but incredibly supportive of it, to me is just a perversion of the philosophy. Justice is a core virtue of Stoicism. Being politically active is an imperative of Stoicism. In fact, Seneca talks about the difference between Epicureanism and Stoicism. He says the Epicurean only gets involved in politics if they have to. The Stoic only isn't involved in politics, he says, if there is some dangerous emergency reason why they cannot be involved. So as we go into this debate, as we go into this election, I don't mean to make things political, but I would say that the Stoics would be looking at this moment as an opportunity. They would see it as an imperative that one votes, that one participates, that one says, look, there may always be evil and bad people and incompetent politicians in the world, but they would say, I'm not going to accept or tolerate it if there is an opportunity for me to make a difference. I won't allow a wrong to be done in my name. I think this is what the Stoics would say. You know, as I say about Cato, a Stoic does not go quietly into that good night. A Stoic does not accept injustice if they have even a 1 in 1,000 chance of making a difference. The Stoics get involved. And I would say the final thing that the Stoics believed about themselves, about the politicians they supported, about the people they hired, the idea of character being fate, right? So again, you can disagree or agree on certain political issues, but what the Stoics would have insisted on, not just of themselves, but of the leaders they selected into office, of the causes they donated to, they would demand character from them in return, and they wouldn't tolerate cheating or lying or indifference or incompetence in any way, because this is a violation of everything that the Stoics hold dear. And in fact, that idea of holding these things dear, we have an extra chapter, three extra chapters, actually. If you pre-order the book, if you buy it this week, you go to dailystoic.com/lives. We have three bonus chapters that I wasn't able to fit in the book. And one of those is about General Mattis, a lifelong fan of Marcus Aurelius. Mattis talks about holding the line. And I think that's what a Stoic does in a moment like this. We can't magically transform things. We can't magically fix them, but we can hold the line. We can say, I'm not going to contribute to things getting worse. I'm going to try to make them better as best as I can, because that's my obligation as a citizen. That's what those four virtues of courage and moderation and justice and wisdom demand of me. So that's all I had today. It was awesome to talk with you guys. You can put all your questions in the chat and we'll kick these around. And again, it was a complete honor. Thank you for supporting the book. I'm really proud of this one. Like I said, I wish it wasn't as timely as it turned out to be, but here we are. And let's do the best we can. So someone was asking how to spell the middle philosopher I talked about. That's Agrippinus. A-G-R-I-P-P-I-N-S. And he's in the middle of the book. There's a table of contents, but Agrippinus is a fascinating guy. Someone, Steve Cardosa, asked about straying from Stoicism, about falling short. I think this is an inevitable reality of any philosophy, of any religion. In Stoicism, you know, it isn't this idea that if you sin, if you mess up, you go to hell and you need to beg for forgiveness. That's not what the Stoic logic is. The Stoic logic is, look, if you're not living rightly, if you're not living in accordance with nature, if you're violating those four virtues, I think the Stoic argument is that your life will come to feel like hell. And so that's the bad news. The good news is you have the power to change that at any time. And so for the Stoic, the idea, there's a beautiful passage from Marcus Aurelius about picking yourself up when you fail, when you lose the rhythm, the flow of life. What you have to do is take a deep breath and return to it, come back to it. So when I find myself drifting, I just try to go back to the original sources. I try to do a little reading. I try to root myself back in the ideas, and I find that tends to recenter and reconnect me. Hugh Connolly is asking, why didn't the people of Rome think Marcus's behavior of mercy and forgiveness was a weakness? I mean, I think it was quite obvious that it wasn't a weakness. He was universally lauded. He was believed even in his own time to be one of the great men of all of history. Some polarization, there were some people who didn't like him, and clearly there was a coup. But when you really see a leader who is thoughtful, who is empathetic, who understands human beings, who treats human beings as flawed but fundamentally good people, again, these are all, I think, similarities between Marcus and Lincoln. Even when you disagree with them, even when you think maybe you'd do it differently yourself, it's hard not to admire them. And look, there was a hardness and a determination in Marcus as well. I mean, he leads troops in battle successfully. You know, he hands down hard judgments and sentences. He is by no means a complete softy. Often it is true that philosophically sort of intellectual leaders can be weak, but that just wasn't the case with Marcus. And I think that was, you know, the source of some of his greatness. someone's talking about Desmond Howard's idea of control the controllables. How else do you apply stoicism to athletes and coaches? Well, yeah, that distinction between what's up to me, what's not up to me is an essential stoic premise. I have a great video on YouTube you can check out where we talk about you control how you play. You don't control the refs, you control how you play. You don't control the weather, you control how you play. You don't control your teammates, you control how you play, right? Ultimately, and I've talked to professional athletes about this, it seems simple, but the human mind is not content to just focus on what you control. It wants to control everything. So I guess what I would say is I wouldn't underestimate that or undersell that as a major breakthrough. It's a big one. But you know, the idea of determination, the idea of practice, the idea of preparing for adversity, these are all really essential parts of the Stoic philosophy. And I think why it's well-suited to us, why sports and stoicism are well suited to each other. There's a chapter in the book about an early Stoic named Chrysippus. And Chrysippus is actually an elite athlete. He runs distance running. It's a really strange event. You do like a few hundred, almost wind sprint style laps that are about 200 yards long each. Actually he coins a Stoic principle that academics now refer to as the sort of the no shoving rule. And so he talks about how winning is great and wanting to win is great and doing everything you can do to win is great up until the line of your actions having a negative impact on another person. Right. And I think this is, you know, again, even 2000 years ago, the Stoics were wrestling with, you know, the idea of what's allowed and what you can get away with, and also what's sort of ethically right and the gray area between those things. Are there any politicians today that you would say fit the description of a Stoic? Look, I get this weird thing because I talk about our political situation and people get upset that I'm being political. And I think there's a big difference between being engaged and active politically. And I think it's imperative that writers and thinkers and artists use their platform to be engaged in that sense. I think it's the wrong decision to take a sort of a philosophical platform and to use it to advance very specific policies. So like to me, when I look at the police brutality issue, I don't see that as a political issue. To me, that's a human rights issue. When I look at the destruction of democratic norms that have occurred under the Trump administration, that's my problem is not that a Republican is doing that. My problem is that that's a betrayal of what this country is supposed to stand for. I'm not upset that Donald Trump cheats on his taxes because, again, because he's a Republican. I have a problem with people cheating on their taxes. And I have a problem with people who are, you know, hold power and then use that power to bully, to lie, to mislead, to enrich oneself. So I don't think the idea of like, hey, who's a politician who I identify as Stoic and then we should go support them for that reason. What I think we want to see are politicians adhering to these Stoic principles within the ideological spectrum that they occupy. So I think, you know, John McCain's final decision to vote against the attempt to repeal the Affordable Care Act, to me, it was a moment of greatness and a moment of stoicism, not because whatever my private opinions are about Obamacare, but because here was a man living up to his principles, even though it was not just a politically unpopular move, but he did it with quite literally one of his dying breaths. And so I think McCain was one of the last politicians in a generation to really embody those ideas. And I say that as someone who had the opportunity to vote for him in one election and didn't. To me, what stoicism brings to the political arena, and I've had the privilege of talking to a number of politicians of both parties, what it should bring is not specific prescriptions, I don't know, related to gun control or taxation or how the Department of Education is run, but it should instruct the kinds of the character and the kinds of decisions that one makes within their own party and within their ideological beliefs. Someone is saying that they have a 17-year-old son who believes that the ultimate form of stoicism is to become a robot of reason. Well, actually, so I would encourage them to read this passage from Marcus Aurelius. This is what Marcus learns from Sextus. And Sextus is a fascinating philosopher. It's actually Plutarch's grandson, who's a major source in the book. And the incredible thing, there's a story of Marcus Aurelius going to attend a lecture of Sextus well into his reign of emperor. Someone asks, what are you doing? And he says, I am going to see Sextus to learn that which I do not yet know, which to me is wonderful. But this is what he says. An example of fatherly authority in the home, what it means to live as nature requires, gravity without errors, to show intuitive sympathy for friends, tolerance to amateurs and sloppy thinkers. His ability to get along with everyone, sharing his company was the highest of compliments, and the opportunity was an honor for those around him. To investigate and analyze with understanding and logic the principles by which we ought to live by, not to display anger or other emotions, to be free of passion, yet full of love, to praise without bombast, to display expertise without pretension. So I don't know. I'm sure there's room to disagree, but that to me, that description from Marcus Aurelius does not strike me as a robot of reason. It strikes me as actually quite a wonderful person, a person capable of joy and happiness and laughter, but also a person who's protected themselves from the depths of despair and rage and bitterness and resentment and hatred. Someone mentions, what can we learn about Marcus Aurelius' addiction to opium? It's very worth pointing out that there is some academics who think that there may have been, Marcus may have had an opium addiction. And this is from the fact that Galen was known to prescribe opium and, you know, in whatever its rudimentary form of the time was. And a reading by an academic many years ago of Meditations, where Marcus describes things like running along the course of the stars and floating above the sky, looking down. The writer theorizes or psychologizes from this that Marcus must have often been high, and this is where this sort of these sort of images are coming from. I think first off, the exercises that Marcus Aurelius are doing are long philosophical traditions, taking the view from above, you know, looking out of an airplane. If I picked up your diary and I saw you write a little thing about how you were looking out of the window of an airplane and it reminded you of how small things were, how connected everything was, I wouldn't say, from that reading, Michael Davis is clearly an opium addict. That's just not the read I would get. So I disagree with the premise. Someone is asking about my next book. I can't tell you, but I can say that I am hard at work on it. Someone was asking, would there be more signed books for me in the Daily Stoic store? Actually, yes, they just went up today. If you go to store.dailystoic.com, you can get signed copies of any of my books. We have them there, and we are currently out of stock of the leather-bound edition of the Daily Stoic, but that we are waiting on the shipment, and that should be here sometime in mid-November. If I wanted to be the mentee of a successful person, and how would I approach it? Look, you don't approach a person and make them your mentor. A mentor selects you, right? That's what happened for Marcus Aurelius. Hadrian sees something in him and chooses him. The idea that you would go up to a pretty stranger in a bar and say, would you be my girlfriend, or do you want to get married? You know, these are ways to creep people out. A mentorship is something that evolves, that happens over time. I started doing transcription work for Robert Greene, and that blossomed into a fuller mentorship that continues to this day. So there's a great line from Sheryl Sandberg. She says, it's not if you have a mentor, you will do well. It's if you do well, a mentor will find you. And I really like that. Anna says that she ordered a copy in January and have not received the bonus items. Then I'm guessing you have not followed the pre-order instructions, which you can do at dailystoic.com/lives. Someone asked, how do we contribute to the political discourse when everything is so divisive and there are societal pressures not to take strong chances? Well, I would say a couple things. One, I'm not sure the discourse needs more contributions. I would say people need to get off their ass and make hard decisions. You have to decide who you're going to vote for. You're going to have to decide what cause you're going to support. You're going to have to decide how are you going to contribute to those causes in a way. I think that's almost the problem is everyone thinks like, well, I'm tweeting about this, therefore I'm making a difference. I don't think that's sufficient. I don't think the Stoics would agree that that's sufficient either. So I think the societal pressure against taking strong chances, I would urge you to read the Agrippinus chapter in the book. You know, I don't give a fuck what people think. And I'll get angry emails from people that says, oh, I'm, you know, unsubscribing from your emails, or I'm never going to buy one of your books because you supported this cause, or you said this, or you dared to criticize the person I've decided that I unquestioningly support. My response to that is, I don't choose my opinions. I don't choose what I believe is right based on whether I think it's going to be popular or not and whether I think it's going to help my career or not. I do it because I think that it's right. So the societal pressure against taking a stand, I mean, to me, the Stoic rejects that out of hand. What I would say is that our obligation is to speak up when we see things that are happening. It's to be clear and emphatic while still being empathetic and kind, and to try to move things forward rather than simply point the finger and blame. Someone's asking about my interview with Jocko and the idea of extreme ownership. Look, I love Jocko. I think his stuff's great. And we did talk a little bit about Stoicism. I think Jocko is a great example of somebody who, like an Antoninus Pius, who is intuitively and naturally Stoic rather than maybe someone who's deeply versed in the philosophy, but in a way, I almost find that more inspiring and more interesting. And I love his stuff. And if you want to check out the interview, you can. Somebody asked about the stuff in the Daily Stoic store. Do we ship? Yeah, as far as I know, we ship all over. Certainly, we've sold stuff in India before, so check that out. Somebody's asking about, were there Stoics who struggled with mental health issues? I mean, obviously, in the ancient world, these things were much less understood. And so there's not, you know, here's Marcus Aurelius's battle with depression, or here's, you know, Seneca's struggle with, bipolar disorder or something. That's not to say it didn't exist. It's just not how we understood it. But I will say what's really interesting to me is that if you're familiar with cognitive behavioral therapy, which I've done a bit myself, it's actually the teachings of Albert Ellis are rooted in the core teachings of Stoicism. So I don't think the Stoics would at all be against therapy, against seeking medical help. And in fact, one of the things I do tend to point people to is there's a great quote from Marcus Aurelius, which I think is worth saying these days. You know, he says, there's no shame in asking for help, asking a fellow soldier for a leg or a hand up, right? So I certainly don't think the Stoics would stigmatize, mental health issues. And if they knew what we knew now, I think we'd obviously hear a lot from them. So I got time for one more. Are there any female leaders who I think embody Stoic principles? That was a really important thing to me writing this book. I did not want it to be just a bunch of old guys. So there's a chapter, one of my favorite ones to write is about Portia Cato, who's Cato's daughter. She's an integral part of the conspiracy to assassinate Julius Caesar. She's a total badass. She embodies Stoicism at its absolute best. Flash forward a few hundred years, Musonius Rufus famously says that, you know, virtue has nothing to do with gender and advocates teaching both boys and girls philosophy young. So the Stoics were early to the idea of equality between the sexes at that level. So we talk a little bit about that. But if you check out the bonus stuff, which you can do at dailystoic.com/lives, I also have a profile of Arianna Huffington, who grew up in Greece, was introduced to Stoicism really early, and in fact carries a note card with a quote from Marcus Aurelius around in her purse everywhere she goes. So the connection between And I happen to see, because I obviously have the back end stats, you know, the audience for Daily Stoic and for my books is, it's actually quite evenly distributed across men and women. I think, unfortunately, the ancient world was a man's world. So most of the people we know or were famous were men. But you know, to me, the sort of quiet dignity, the endurance, the absolute fearlessness and determination of, you know, generations of women who worked and lived alongside these Stoic men, to me is just as much living the philosophy as the people who wrote the philosophical books that we happen to be drawing from. So great. And the last question someone asked, this wouldn't have happened if it wasn't for the pandemic. Will I do more? Yes, of course. I love digital stuff. And if you like digital stuff from me, I do one of these every single quarter for the members of Daily Stoic Life, which you can check out at dailystoiclife.com. So guys, thank you so much. I hope everyone's being safe. I hope you're keeping your head amidst all the craziness. I hope you're sticking to what's, you know, to be true and right. And I hope you're wearing a mask, being smart, being safe, taking care of your neighbors, your family, and yourself. Thank you guys very much. Appreciate it.
If you like the podcast that we do here and you want to get it via email every morning, you can sign up at dailystoic.com/email.
Hey, Prime members, you can listen to the Daily Stoic early and ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today, or you can listen early and ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts.
Okay, so if you had a time machine, how far in time would you need to go back to be a dominant basketball player of that era?
I need to go to when Bob Cousy was playing.
Back in the plumber days?
27-year-old Shea would give Bob Cousy the f***ing business. He's not guarding me.
Hi, I'm Jason Concepcion.
And I'm Shea Serrano, and we are back. We have a new podcast from Wondery. It's called Six Trophies.
Woo!
And it's the best.
Each week, Shay and I are combing through all of the NBA storylines, finding the best, most interesting, most compelling ones, and then handing out six pop culture themed trophies for six basketball related activities.
Trophies like the Dominic Toretto I Live My Life a Quarter Mile at a Time trophy, which is given to someone who made a short-term decision with no regard for future consequence.
Or the Christopher Nolan Tenet trophy, which is given to someone who did something that we didn't understand.
Catalina Wine Mixer trophy.
Ooh, the Lauryn Hill You Might Win Some But You Just Lost One trophy. Follow Six Trophies on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to Six Trophies ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus.